Commissioned Corps, as you see from his uniform today. He has co-authored recent ACIP recommendations for hepatitis A vaccine, hepatitis B vaccine, and recently for influenza vaccine. His current duties include acting as CDC liaison to the ACIP Influenza Vaccine Working Group and developing seasonal influenza vaccine policy. Dr. Fiore.
Good morning, and thanks for sticking around for the very last session, with the exception of Melinda Wharton's sum-up session. But I realize that, stick around for that too. but I realize that this has been a long conference, and I appreciate you sticking around for a fairly, what could be a real whirlwind tour of vaccine effectiveness studies in influenza, in the influenza world. This is just a summary of what I'm going to talk about today. This is just give you a very cursory, very cursory review of influenza epidemiology and vaccinology, talk about some key elements in vaccine effectiveness studies, some of the recent studies that have been published in the past couple of years, and the controversies, particularly around vaccination of older individuals, and then just a couple slides looking ahead at what we might expect in the near horizon. Just a brief review. As you know, influenza is a highly transmissible respiratory illness. It's caused by influenza viruses, the strains currently circulating, the influenza A subtypes are H1N1 and H3N2. Influenza B is separated into lineages, and the two lineages currently circulating and have been circulating for about the past 10 to 15 years are Victoria-like viruses and Yamagata-like viruses. These yearly epidemics are called seasonal influenza. These occur in temperate climates. We have new information in the last 10 years that influenza can be transmitted year-round in some parts of the tropics, but we're learning more about that. It's an important point that illness that's caused by influenza viruses can't easily be distinguished with clinical criteria from other acute respiratory illnesses. You need specific laboratory testing to determine what proportion of influenza-like illness, in quotes there, from our influenza and which proportion are caused by other acute respiratory illnesses, and particularly respiratory viruses. The term antigenic drift refers to point mutations in influenza A viruses, point mutations and recombinations that over the course of time change the virus enough so that persons who've been previously infected or previously vaccinated have a diminished immune response to these drifted strains and are not fully protected. And what this requires is that we update the vaccine, the trivalent vaccine, with the representative of each of those strains I showed you above. It has to be updated yearly to match the predicted strains that are going to be circulating. Of course, there are pandemics, sporadic and unpredictable, three in the last century, and these are influenza A pandemics. I won't talk more about that, but it's always interesting to me to remind people that the H1N1 and the H3N2 that we see currently circulating are the descendants of those pandemic viruses. The three strains that are selected to make trivalent vaccine are based on global viral surveillance and the availability of suitable vaccine candidates. As I mentioned, we have a representative from each of the influenza A subtypes and one of the two influenza B lineages. We have to make this vaccine selection decision well before the peak influenza season, typically 10 to 12 months before, because the Northern Hemisphere vaccines are selected in February before the influenza season, with the peak season typically being in January or February of the following year, and the Southern Hemisphere strains selected in September. And the result is that we have a new vaccine, one or more new strains, nearly every season, and of course we go into every August with 0% coverage. No other vaccine has that. The determinants of immune response to influenza vaccines include age and immune competence. Of course, we're all well aware that elderly persons, infants, chronically ill persons generally have a lower antibody response, but there's also, over the last 10 or 15 years, this developing understanding of the concept of a difficult-to-say-and-spell word called immunosenescence, which is a sort of a description of a global deterioration in overall immune capacity as persons get older. Even healthier persons get older. They have fewer hematopoietic stem cells capable of differentiating into specific immune cells that can respond to a vaccination or to natural infection. Another important determinant of immune response to influenza vaccines is your previous history, and whether you've been infected before with influenza viruses or even previously vaccinated. And it's one reason that young children require two doses below the age of 9, because they don't have experience with viruses or previous vaccination. Two doses when they're first vaccinated, the first year they're vaccinated. The virus strains vary as to how robust the immune responses will be. I think that's an underappreciated phenomenon, that the year to year, the vaccine strains stimulate a slightly different immune response, and some years the immune response will have quite high antibody titers, and other year it won't be as high. And how that plays out in terms of how well the vaccine works is not well understood. So what do you look for when you're looking at vaccine effectiveness studies in the influenza world? Well, it's really quite complicated. The first major bullet here are variables that I think are unique to influenza, and I'll spend the first part of the talk talking about them. And that is virus and illness variables. Antigenic match is a term that you see a lot in the paper. It does not equate to vaccine effectiveness. It's one component of vaccine effectiveness, and this refers to how well the circulating viruses match up with those viruses that are represented in the vaccine. The intensity of the season comes into play. I'll show you a slide later that gives a pretty dramatic example of that. The types of viruses that are circulating, because in general, very generally speaking, H3N2 years where H3N2 is predominant tend to have more morbidity and mortality than years where influenza B predominates, and H1N1 is perhaps the least virulent of the viruses. That's a general statement. People die from H1N1 infection each year, and people have mild illness with H3N2. But generally speaking, and I'll show you in a minute, we see worse years when H3N2 predominates. Study design, of course, is something that comes into play with vaccine effectiveness studies with other antigens. Outcomes measured in influenza vaccine effectiveness studies, vaccine effectiveness studies, include influenza-like illness, laboratory-confirmed influenza, and then we have modeling studies in which we take influenza-related hospitalizations and deaths, predict which proportion are really due to influenza based on medical database information and viral surveillance information. There's the old randomized control with a placebo-controlled trial, which is an ideal, harder and harder to achieve now that we have recommendations for most of the population. And there's also observational studies, which are probably most of the vaccine effectiveness studies that you've seen recently. And of course, the setting and participants matter, as I mentioned before, people respond in different ways to the vaccine. So you need to know about your age groups and your risk groups in the study. And of course, selection of controls in any vaccine effectiveness study is a critical factor. So this is just an example of the vaccine match issues. And I've used the influenza B virus lineages because they're a particularly dramatic example of antigenic match. As I mentioned, there are two influenza B lineages that have co-circulated over the past 10 years in the U.S., and they're broadly referred to as Yamagata-like and Victoria-like. We know that protection after vaccination using one representative from one lineage is limited when you get exposed to a virus from the other lineage. And what this means is that we go into every season, if we assume there's going to be co-circulation that season, knowing that we're going to have some degree of mismatch between the B virus strains that are in the vaccine and the strains that actually end up circulating. This is an example, 10 years worth of data, and there's two factors to look at here. First of all, it's the percentage of illnesses that are due to influenza B, and of course that's a critical factor. So what if you mismatch if there's very few influenza B? Well, you can see there's a broad range of percentage of illnesses due to B, anywhere from 1% here on this slide to 43%. And as far as in the last 10 years, the percent of B circulating that don't match those in vaccines, this too has varied a great deal, from 1% all the way up to, in 07, 08, 98% when we had a Victoria-like antigen in the vaccine, and 98% of the viruses that we characterized that were circulating were Yamagata-like. So you can see in that year, we didn't have a particularly good influenza B vaccine. This is just an example of the variability I mentioned of what you see for seasons according to estimated mortality. This is modeling data. You can see in red, you see the worst year in this 10-year span for a particular virus, and in the gray, the least worst year. So you can see that for example, for influenza B, there were 12,000 deaths in 92, 93 due to influenza B. And then in the following year, we estimated only about 250 deaths. So there's a great range in terms of if you're looking for a severe outcome like mortality, you really have to think about what's circulating because you'll see a wide range. You can see it's about 50-fold or so difference from one year to the next. Not only that, but there's variability over the course of a season. This is 2007-2008. The three viruses are represented in three colors here. Early in the season, in red, you can see it was an H1N1 season, just for the first couple weeks of last season, that is the 2007-2008 season. We quickly had a large surge of H3N2, which ended up being the predominant virus for the season, but we did see some late-breaking B there, and a good bit of influenza B towards the tail end of the season. I don't have the data to show you for this season yet, but if you were to see it, you would see that this season was predominantly an H1N1 season. We've seen very little H3N2. We are seeing a lot of influenza B right now, so this curve would look completely different for this season. There's variability by geography also, and this, I've broken it up here into regions, but I suspect you would see the same thing if you were to break it down into even smaller regions. The three different viruses are represented by three different colors here. Just looking, for example, at the B viruses, which are orange, up in the Pacific Northwest, you had nearly 50% of the viruses that were characterized were influenza Bs. And look down in the Southeast, there wasn't a whole lot of influenza B. There was a lot of H3N2, which is in blue. So depending on where you conduct your study, you could see a pretty different vaccine effectiveness because each of those components of the vaccine has a different effectiveness associated with this, with it. If influenza B is not working very well, and you have mostly influenza B, your vaccine effectiveness is not going to be very good. So the ideal influenza vaccine effectiveness study takes into account this virus and season variability. So what you would like to see is multiple seasons, multiple sites, good virus surveillance, which includes both typing and subtyping, but also antigenic characterization. The reality is we rarely achieve this ideal. It's important to keep these principles in mind, though, when you look at a study that has one season, one site, when you're thinking about how generalizable this study is. It's important not to declare victory or defeat based upon one study, one season, one site. Let's talk a little bit about study design here. I showed you this slide earlier, and I've grayed out the topics we've already covered. First, selection of influenza vaccine effectiveness outcomes. Now, many studies use outcomes that are based on influenza-like symptoms or a syndrome and don't look at laboratory confirmation. And this is, of course, a less specific outcome than laboratory confirmed. The result is that you have a lower vaccine effectiveness because you have a lot of noise. There's other circulating respiratory pathogens that wouldn't be prevented by influenza vaccine that are causing influenza-like illness that you're measuring as illness. So example of some of these outcomes you see are the old ILI, which is typically acute onset of fever plus either cough or sore throat. But you also have studies that show influenza-related hospitalization or deaths that are based upon medical database studies, ICD-9 codes, that are then modeled on virus surveillance to predict what proportion of illnesses, for example, pneumonia and that are coded as pneumonia and influenza, are truly due to influenza. I'll give you an example of that in a moment. This is an example of the made-up example of the issue of looking at a non-specific outcome versus a specific outcome. Now, just focus on the red bars for the moment. Those red bars are true influenza viruses, virus infections. You have two different situations here, situation A and situation B. And if you look at the red bars, you can see in A and B that they're proportionally similar in both the vaccinated in each situation and the unvaccinated in each situation. And you have the same estimate of vaccine effectiveness in those two situations. And so if you're looking at lab-confirmed outcomes, that's fine. These two situations look the same. If you're looking at influenza-like illness, however, that's all of the rest of the bar there, all of the yellow part of the bar. In the two different situations now, you would have a different calculation of vaccine effectiveness if your outcome is influenza-like illness. In the first one, in the situation A, you'd have a 30% effectiveness. In situation B, you'd have 15% effectiveness. And 15% effectiveness can be hard to see unless you have a pretty big study. You might conclude that it wasn't much effectiveness at all if you're looking at influenza-like illness and you only have a 15% effectiveness because you might not be able to distinguish that from no effectiveness. If you'd use laboratory confirmed outcomes, though, you'd see it had a pretty good effectiveness. Again, that's a made-up example. This is an example of the modeling studies. This is you've many times seen the quote of an average of 226,000 hospitalizations per year. Here it is broken out by age group. This is a study that was done over a 20-year time span using National Hospital Discharge Survey data the codes associated with pneumonia and influenza, and then modeling them on our virus surveillance to predict how many were due to actual influenza. There weren't any lab-confirmed influenza, very few lab-confirmed influenza cases in this. This is modeled data. It's robust in the sense that people have used other methods to look at it and have come up with fairly similar results, but it's modeled data. So just to just mention a few things about laboratory-confirmed influenza. Again, to reiterate, it's the most specific because ILI can be caused by many pathogens. There is a potential pitfall with laboratory-confirmed influenza as an outcome, and that is that persons who get tested might be different from persons who don't get tested. Let's talk about issues in vaccine effectiveness among older persons now. This has been a major issue with observational vaccine effectiveness studies that use these medical diagnostic databases. And there's a couple of concepts that you'll see in the literature. One is confounding by indication, and this is, at least as I understand it from the influenza literature, means that there's a greater representation in the vaccinated group of persons that have chronic medical conditions. This is something you can control for if you know what their underlying medical conditions are. There's the healthy vaccinee effect, which is sort of a variant of this, and that's where there's greater representation in the vaccinated group of persons who might be less likely to have some outcome that you're studying. So if the persons are generally healthier, they're less likely to die in general, whether or not they get vaccinated against influenza. However, those healthy persons might be more likely to be vaccinated. And the last one that's really come into play in the last couple of years is sort of the converse of this concept, and that's called frailty bias. And that's a growing understanding that there may be a greater representation in the unvaccinated groups of persons that have a diminished functionality for activities of daily living that aren't easily captured in medical database studies. It's functionalities like ability to bathe yourself, ability to get out of bed. These are bad signs if you're going into influenza season, but it's not something that necessarily shows up in your medical record, at least not in the coding that is used to do some of these studies. The analysis methods that are used to control for confounding are listed here, the main point here is that frailty bias is particularly difficult to control for when using medical databases. And I'm not going to say a whole much more about this because this is a whole hour lecture in itself, this concept, and it's quite controversial. But if you want to see two different viewpoints on this, I suggest reading those two articles that I've listed at the bottom. There's a growing literature on this. So when we're talking about vaccine effectiveness in older persons, we end up looking back at the single randomized controlled trial that we have available. This is a trial conducted in the Netherlands among persons 60 years and older. It's important to note that these were community-dwelling older persons. They were quite healthy in general. Only 27% had a chronic illness. This table is not actually from the paper. It's from a reanalysis that was sent in by the authors in response to some of these controversies that I just mentioned, in which they reanalyzed and broke it down a little better by age group than they had. Originally, they had reported 58% effectiveness amongst all persons 60 and older. In this table, you can see they broke it down into 60 to 69 as compared to those 70 and above, and found pretty similar effectiveness, 59%, 57%. They had few enough people in the group 70 and above that they could not actually show a statistically significant effect here, because the confidence range, you can see, went from -36% to 87%. But still, the point estimate was really pretty close to what they saw for the younger folks. Again, a relatively healthy group of older people. The ACIP Influenza Working Groups has looked at these data extensively and presented at an ACIP meeting in October the following points: that they support prospective population-based studies with lab-confirmed endpoints to look at influenza vaccine effectiveness. They'd like to see more efforts to increase vaccine immunogenicity in the frail elderly. And we will continue to review studies of new methods of delivering vaccine, alternative doses, alternative schedules, and most importantly, new adjuvanted vaccines that may be available soon. Just a few words about vaccine effectiveness in younger persons. We have probably better data in this age group because we have a number of randomized controlled trials, including a series of randomized controlled trials done over multiple years in the Michigan area. Here's 3 years worth of data. The first two are published. The third was presented at an IDSA meeting recently, and you can see it on the web. And so you can see the couple points to make here is that vaccine effectiveness varied a good deal over the 3 years. And in fact, 2007, 2008, a year when we talked about antigenic mismatch a lot, at least among persons, younger healthy persons, vaccine effectiveness remained quite good. You can see 10.8% of those who got placebo had lab-confirmed influenza. Only 3.4% of those who got vaccinated had lab-confirmed influenza for a vaccine effectiveness of 68%. 2005-2006 was an interesting year. It was thought that the vaccine was actually a pretty good antigenic match, but it was a pretty light year, especially in Michigan. You can see very few people got sick. Only 1.8% of those who got the placebo got influenza, lab-conferred influenza illness. Very hard to show a vaccine effectiveness when you have illness rates that low. The vaccine effectiveness was estimated to be 16%. The Marshfield, Wisconsin studies now become a series of studies also. This is a slightly different methodology, includes all persons who get vaccinated in that area. It's not just young, healthy persons, but it is generally a fairly healthy population. It does include some older persons. They all live in the Marshfield, Wisconsin area. Cases are persons who come in for medical, for influenza infection. It gets diagnosed by RT-PCR, which is a gold standard for diagnosis. Controls are persons who come in are RT-PCR negative, so they're called test negative controls. Last season, towards the end of the season, David Shea and his colleagues at Marshfield, Ed Belongia among them, was able to show vaccine effectiveness of 44% in this group, with a variety of different vaccine effectivenesses when you broke it down further. For example, those recommended by the ACIP for vaccination, it was 34% effective. Healthy 5 to 49-year-olds, 54%. For influenza A, 58%. Influenza B, pretty bad, actually negative 35%. Let's call it zero, actually, because of the wide confidence interval. This is the season, remember, when we had a very bad influenza B mismatch in the sense that the lineage and the vaccine were completely different. This is an exciting trial just published in the last year. I think it's one of the more interesting trials I've seen recently. This was actually conducted in Bangladesh over 2004-2005, although not published till 2008, a randomized controlled trial, so a gold standard sort of trial in which they vaccinated pregnant women in their third trimester with either influenza vaccine or they had an active control of pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine. And they looked at a variety of different outcomes, including nonspecific ones like febrile respiratory illness among the infants and mothers, but also lab-confirmed influenza among infants. Remember, infants were not vaccinated, just the moms. The infants were followed up through the first 6 months of age. And what they saw is, looking at the little circles there, is that protection for against respiratory illness, any respiratory illness with fever, was about 30%, a significant protection rate, not looking at lab-confirmed influenza. When they did look at lab-confirmed influenza, the protection for the infants was actually 63%, you can see in the second oval there. And protection among the mothers after vaccination was about 36%. This is an important study, I think, because even though it's one site, and remember I cautioned you about one site, one place, one year, I think it's we don't have a way to protect infants younger than the age of 6 months at this point. They can't be vaccinated. They don't get antivirals. And so it's an important step to be able to show that there might be protection by vaccinating the mom. We don't know whether this is through reduction in exposure by the infant to an infected mom or whether it's actually transfer of maternal antibodies at this point. I think we will know in the near future, but we don't know yet. So just to summarize the common vaccine effectiveness study methodologies, you have your randomized controlled studies. They're a gold standard. They're very difficult to do in the U.S. now because, as you know, most people have a recommendation for vaccination, and it's no longer probably ethical to withhold vaccine and give placebo to persons that have an annual recommendation. And also, persons who volunteer for a randomized controlled trial are not normal in the standard sense. They're an unusual group. They might be somewhat more healthy than others. Observational studies continue to get used because they're there and the data is available for use. They might better capture a representative population than a randomized controlled study does. But these confounding issues that I mentioned, particularly frailty bias, remain unresolved, and fortunately there's a lot of discussion about how we might resolve them. Observational studies that use test negative controls, such as is done in the Marshfield area, continue to be useful, although we continue to have questions about whether test negative controls are truly representative of the source populations. As far as what CDC is doing for vaccine assessments and things you might see in the near future, there are four U.S. sites that are funded for the next 3 years and started their work this year to look at vaccine effectiveness for lab-confirmed medically attended outcomes. This includes all persons similar to Marshfield. In fact, Marshfield is one of the sites that are recommended for vaccination, controls or test negatives. It's powered to assess vaccine effectiveness against hospitalization. And we have the potential to generate within-season vaccine effectiveness estimates, as was done last season. There's an emerging infections program study that's a bit large surveillance area that many of you might be involved with that will be looking at lab-confirmed influenza among persons that are hospitalized using community controls. And we have two international studies that are just going to get up and running this season in Senegal and India, where we think we have a real opportunity to look more extensively at the idea that there might be indirect effects from vaccination of children, indirect effects in the sense of protecting unvaccinated other community members. Issues on the near horizon, I've lumped them into four categories, but there is lots of exciting stuff in this world right now. We'd like to see replication of some of the intriguing findings, intradermal vaccination, for example, which I haven't said anything about today, but is worth looking into. The vaccine effectiveness among infants that are born to vaccinated women. We need to have better methods to reduce confounding and observational studies among the elderly. These are ongoing discussions amongst the various groups that have done these studies. I think it's been very productive to see that happening. And I think we will have epidemiologic methods that will be better able to control for that potential for confounding, or at least identify how much confounding there really is. Other issues on the near horizon, might we have more effective vaccines soon? Well, there are large randomized controlled trials of adjuvanted vaccines versus the standard vaccine. Several of the companies are doing these trials now. A second interesting development is that FDA and the manufacturers have been discussing having a quadrivalent vaccine. That is a vaccine that has two A subtypes and then both of the two B strains, B lineages represented in the vaccine for the U.S. I don't think this is going to happen in the next season or two, but it might be happening relatively soon, and we'll get away at least from that problem with mismatch. And finally, we're looking at having a better ability to predict the circulating strains. We have increased and more representative virus surveillance globally. We have a better understanding of the molecular epidemiology and the geographic spread of drifted strains. And I think we have a better understanding of critical antigenic properties over the next few years. Critical antigenic properties to really understand what these antigenic characterization data that we generate each year really mean in terms of vaccine effectiveness. Thank you.